WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Back in 1967, a famous line in Mike Nichols' movie The Graduate signaled a new attitude toward the role of synthetic materials in American life. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts about what has changed since then and what hasn't.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
If The Graduate had come out in 1957 instead of 1967, the nation wouldn't have seen much to snicker about in that famous line where a skeptical Dustin Hoffman received some career advice from a family friend. Until the 60s, plastic connoted all the blessings that science was bestowing on modern life. The American enchantment with synthetics really got going in the 1920s. Bakelite caught on as a material for everything from fountain pens to telephones, and designers like Elsa Schiaparelli redeemed viscose from its tacky associations under the new name of rayon, from the French for beam of light. The transparent version of viscose called cellophane was such a success in both packaging and fashion that Cole Porter listed it among the superlatives of You're the Top, alongside of the Colosseum, the Louvre Museum, Mickey Mouse, and A Summer Night in Spain. And in a 1940 poll to determine the most beautiful word in the English language, cellophane came in third, right behind mother and memory. Nylon took the world by storm when it was debuted at the World's Fair of 1939, where the DuPont Pavilion featured a shapely Miss Chemistry reclining on a podium in nylon stockings. And nylon was followed by a host of new materials with alluring names, lucite, vinyl, formica, styrofoam, dacron, each more miraculous than the last. That filament finally broke in 1963, when DuPont introduced the leather substitute Corfam at the Chicago Shoe Show. The following year, it made the new material the centerpiece of its World's Fair pavilion, a triumph of synthesis from its Tedlar roof and Delrin doorknobs to its Mylar curtains and Fabrilite seat upholstery. DuPont had reason to be confident. Corfam was light and durable and could be cleaned with a wet sponge. It seemed a natural, if you'll excuse the expression. But Corfam was a marketing catastrophe. A few years later, DuPont took a $100 million write-off and sold off its Corfam operation to a company in the People's Republic of Poland, where the material quickly became the rage of captive nation haute couture. People had good practical reasons for rejecting Corfam, which didn't breathe or break in the way leather did. But the material was also the victim of a more equivocal attitude toward synthetic products. As it happens, in fact, 1963 also recorded the first use of the word plastic to refer to something superficial or insincere. From then on, plastic itself would be the P word, charged with a curious ambiguity. For the hippies and later the Greens, the word stood in for all the artificiality of American consumer culture. Frank Zappa captured that spirit in his 1967 song Plastic People from the album Absolutely Free.
Moon above, I searched for years, I found no love. I'm sure that love will never be a product of plasticity, a product of plasticity, a product of.
But the 60s also saw the birth of a new sort of cultural plastophilia. That had less to do with the corporate triumphalism of DuPont's Better Living Through Chemistry than with a cool detachment of pop art and the mods. That was what led performers to take names like Plastic Bertrand and the Plastic Ono Band, and it spawned a line of songs from the Jefferson Airplane's Plastic Fantastic Lover to Bjork's Dear Plastic, a paean to the joys of artifice. Deep down, though, The difference between the two parties was more stylistic than philosophical. It was a question of how you responded to the synthetic superficiality of American middle-class life. The plastophiles assumed a pose of studied irony. Plastic was unhip when it denied its synthetic nature in AstroTurf, Lucite chandeliers, disposable diapers, or polyester leisure suits. Hip plastic was girls in vinyl miniskirts from Mary Quant dancing to Wah Wah Tusi by the Orlons, of course. Spandex was hip, and so was the million square feet of polypropylene sheeting that Christo used to wrap a mile-long section of the Australian coast near Sydney. Needless to say, those distinctions had nothing to do with chemistry or environmental apprehensions. The same molecules could be unhip in car upholstery and chic in a Gucci bag. Not surprisingly, the plastic wars left their marks on the language, too. Once plastic became a term of derision, people started to avoid the word to refer to the new materials that were coming out of the lab. From then on, plastic no longer meant any manufactured polymer the way it did in the 1950s. Now it only connotes glossy materials like vinyl, polystyrene, and lucite. Ask people what their computer housings are made of, and they'll fumble for a name. For that matter, you don't see the word polyester much anymore either. We may still drape our bodies in it, but now it's sold as microfiber or under brand names like Gore-Tex, Polar Fleece, and Ecospun, names that aren't tainted with the downmarket kitsch of Saturday Night Fever. And 40 years after Corfam tanked, synthetic leather is back as the fabric of choice for wildlife-friendly performers like Britney Spears and Janet Jackson. But now it's called pleather, with the P word reduced to an unobtrusive prefix. Pleather. It's not a name in a class with cellophane.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now.